Hello, everyone. Welcome to Press Pause, where we take a short break from our actual play show and do something new, something different, something spontaneous. This is Let's Chat, an interview show where we bring in creatives in the TTRPG space to talk about what they do and why they do it. So today we have two very special guests here for you all, Ned Donovan and Brian David Judkins from Encounter Party. Thank you guys so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Seriously, thank you so much.
I have met Ned briefly before, but I've never met Brian, so it's wonderful to have you on to talk.
I'm elusive. I hibernate during the warm months.
Also,
I only come out around post Halloween.
You're seeing All a right. surprise sighting of Brian David Judkins.
Yeah.
Well, I think we got to start out at the beginning where we all start out.
It's a very good place to start.
Very good place to start. You got there first.
But how did you happen upon this wonderful, magical space that is TTRPGs? Like the very beginning, how did you get into playing Dungeons & Dragons?
Oh, how did we get into playing? Oh,
yeah. Brian's story is better than mine, so I'm going to go first.
Maybe she goes second because I don't want to stuff you.
I was 8 years old. And I was in Portland, Maine, and one of my really good friends' older brother was playing the game, and we would watch his friends play, and then we would try to figure out the rules because they wouldn't teach us the rules. And then I've been playing D&D kind of ever since. I always laugh about this experience now having a television show in the D&D world because when I was a kid, I graduated with 51 kids from high school, very small school, which means I was a varsity athlete, I was a musical theater kid, and the thing I like hid from the world was that I played D&D. And then I went to musical theater school for college, and I continued to play D&D, but with my like non-theater friends, because like, it's not cool, no one can look at me. And then I moved to New York, and I continued to play D&D. And it is very funny to me that the height of my career thus far is coming from the piece of myself that I like hid away when I was 15, 16, 17 years old.
So I was, I think, initially roped into Wizards of the Coast products when Magic the Gathering came out. So I joined during beta, like way back in 93 when I was a little kid. I had a lot of my friends in school had like older brothers who were really smart. So we kind of matured very quickly into those types of games. I was actually born in Italy to American parents. And so we would go back and vacation there quite often to go visit family friends of theirs. And I ended up getting sort of dumped with some high school kids one night so mom and dad could have adult time. And they were like, here, go take them off. And we ended up connecting. My Italian is not great, but we ended up connecting because Diablo 1 had just come out, the video game. And so we were connecting over Diablo. So I kind of got dumped with this guy. I didn't know what we were doing for the night. And we went to go play what ultimately was Dungeons & Dragons. And they had found this section of old Roman Empire ruins that they knew how to get into, that where they wouldn't get in trouble. So we ended up playing in like an old sewer system where they had a table set up. And the DM's DM screen was a record cover sleeve for the vinyl record of It's a Kind of Magic by Queen. So I also got exposed to Queen on that night. And they made their own miniatures and they were playing. And I really kind of didn't understand what was going on. But when I got home, I discovered that my older cousin had played. And I got sucked into so many other games. Wasn't really D&D until about college, because there were so many other games that we were playing, like Star Wars and you know, weird West games and stuff like that too. But yeah, a crazy night sneaking into some old Roman ruins is how I got exposed to D&D.
I do have to say that I think in the sewers of Italy is
it's a
pretty
better
wild story. Yeah, it's a better story.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't think I've heard anything as good as that before. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Abandoned to people sneaking into a sewer as well is how that story.
Yeah, is that where they played all the time?
Yeah, That's where they played. Just had their old table set. They knew this. They knew this section that they could get into where they wouldn't get caught. And one night we went into this old, hollowed out section of some dugout ruins and played, you know, with flash. You know, they had like lanterns and stuff that they set up and lighting. It's pretty crazy.
So you guys have been playing for a long time. Yeah. Do you remember like the very first game that you played in?
No.
No?
The very first Dungeons and Dragons game I played in. Yes, I do remember. Because we had somebody wanted to play the Middle Earth game, and this was before the Peter Jackson movies. So there was an older kid, I think in Boy Scouts, that wanted to play the Middle Earth game, and those rules were insanely complicated. And so we decided as a lighter version, we were going to play Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. But I do remember it only because it's a very good cringeworthy tale about my half vampire ranger. And that's all that's the whole story. That pretty much
half vampire ranger. Well, we can make our own assumptions from that.
You can fill in the blanks there. Speak with animals. Yep.
Yeah.
That's it.
End of
interview.
And we're done. Yeah. See you guys later.
Well, Vampire Hunter D had just made it to the US as well. So I think that was my big influence that it was like.
I will admit, I don't even know what that is. Brian, what is that?
I have the complete artwork collection book that you can borrow. It's gigantic. Vampire Hunter D is they were novels, and then they were manga books out of Japan. That is, if you mix sort of Alucard and Blade, so it is about a half vampire hunter, and they're anthology stories. So they're never about him; they're about who hires him and their own personal struggles. But they're beautiful. And the artwork was done by Amano, who's the guy who did artwork for the Final Fantasy games and stuff like that. Shout out to Vampire Hunter
D. Yeah, there we go.
They're beautiful. First recommendation they're of the so podcast. Emotional. They're so beautiful. They're just absolutely fantastic stories.
Well, do you guys have a favorite TTRPG, and is it D&D?
It's D&D.
Okay.
It is D&D.
Yeah.
I play a lot of them, and I like I like GMing in other systems myself, purely for the sake of I play more D&D than any other, and I think it's fun to see what other systems inspire me to do as a player or as a GM, and then bring them back to my home games that are usually D&D. But D&D is my favorite game. I play a lot of different games, but I always come back to D&D.
We are doing press for a Dungeons & Dragons television show. Dungeons & Dragons is our favorite game.
I also figured it would be anyways if you're creating Dungeons & Dragons 5E television show.
5E is fantastic. Yeah. It really is. Fifth edition is fantastic. It's always nice to sort of dabble in other stuff, but fifth edition is such a clean way to get people to be active, which is something that other RPGs sometimes don't allow you to do, that they require such a barrier between decision to dice rolling to actual action in the fictional story that you're telling. And fifth edition is just so proactive. I remember when they being part of the playtesting beta, like when they sent it out to everybody to play for free to try it. And everyone was blown away by just how quickly you can get in and how super fast and efficiently you can do stuff, which really helps our show because it allows us to stay in the story. It allows us to stay in the fiction and stay in the character development and not either burn time or try and make rule mechanics dramatic, which can be done sometimes but can quickly get tiresome.
Yeah, 5e is the first D&D I ever played, so I don't have any form of I don't know the other ones to compare.
Doesn't even matter. It's 5e is a great game.
But I think that's part of the reason it's been so successful is because of 5th edition, the game has become, it's more approachable and it's easier to teach people. 3.5 was a nightmare and people really liked it, but it was the most unapproachable version of the game I ever experienced because it was so rules heavy and it was so specific. And it was designed that way to give people the ability to be exact and win. Like, that was the problem with it. It's a DM's nightmare because people were, you know, it was 3.5 isn't even an official system, but it was so meticulous to give every player an out to have semantics and specificity. And then 4th edition was a complete flip to that because people accused it of being more of a board game, to which I liked, and I know people are really enjoying Baldur's Gate 3, but to me, Baldur's Gate 3 is 4th edition, in flavor and in style, which was sort of more of a game and stuff like that. But 5th edition, when it came out, they made the decision, we want to get people into their own stories as fast and as streamlined as possible. And so I think without 5th edition, we'd never be able to make a program like this.
Totally.
I know, Brian, you are a DM, and Ned, you just mentioned that you have dabbled in some running of games before. Do you have a preference when it comes to either running games or playing in games?
Player.
Yeah?
Player by far. And the answer is the most selfish, terrible answer. I do not often have time to DM well. I like being a player for a lot of reasons, and I actually think this sort of ties into something I really love about this campaign of the TV program of Encounter Party, but I really like exploring new ways to take on archetypal characters, and being a player gives me the space to do that in a way DM just doesn't have a lot of time to do. You don't get to like sit with one character for that amount of time. That's not how the game works. I'm really excited about this new show. I'm playing a rogue bard multiclass that will neither feel overwhelmingly roguey or overwhelmingly bardy. We are saying rogue bard is a mechanics list. How I play the character is entirely different. And that's always what's fun for me. I have a home game right now where I've built what is conceptually a terrible min-max character. He is a fighter sorcerer, which is a disaster. But all I wanted was to find a way to make Booming Blade and Green Flame Blade awesome. That was it. That was the whole pitch at the beginning of building the character. And spoilers, if any of my home games listening, no one knows he's a sorcerer yet. We've been playing the game for 5 years.
Ooh!
it's about to come out. And everyone thinks he's just a fighter. And everyone's really curious why his fighter abilities aren't keeping up with their leveling up. And the answer is he's gaining some levels in something they haven't seen yet. and I find that really fun as a player. I love writing stories. I love crafting stories. And I love GMing in other systems than D&D because it's actually more fun for me often to play pre-gens in D&D and then explore how I can twist them. But as a player, I just love building archetypal characters that aren't and then seeing where they go.
What about you, Brian?
I'm a forever GM. It just... how it plays out. The reality is I probably do prefer it just because I'm a writer. I'm a creative dude. It's just kind of where life has led me and the skills I've picked up. So I feel the responsibility to craft the type of game experience that I know is possible. We're doing press for this show, so we kind of keep circling back to it. But the entire reason this show exists at all is because I had this idea of how we could do it better, and then called Ned to see if we could. I called Ned with a problem and said, "Can we solve this problem? And if we solve the problem, will this make good content? And will it make good programming?" So. That's a hard thing to ever explain to people, this like feeling of responsibility that comes with my creative work. But also monsters rock. Like go ahead and play your fighter, sorcerer, whatever. I'm going to play an ice troll that has like AoE auras and power slams and auto hit shadow monsters and stuff. Like that to me is really fun, is to craft combats and look at monsters and build a strategy. I feel like I get much more variance playing the game playing that way. And it's incredible sometimes when you're in the moment, especially when you're on set, and you go, oh, I can really rock your world if I do this. I figured out a strategy. I'm a really nice, supportive DM for storytelling, but once the combat dice start rolling, I'm not anybody's friend. I'm there to win.
You mentioned like being a writer and, you know, being a DM is crafting a story and everything. Do you find that you have specific tropes that you really like to focus on in your games that just like kind of keep coming back, recurring themes?
So all of my campaigns so far have all been mystery thrillers. They all involve things for the players to uncover. I think the player base needs to be active. And sometimes I fear that archetypes and tropes turn people on autopilot. If they can sort of smell a familiar plot line, then they just sort of fall into it. And that can be a real detriment as a DM, especially if you're trying to write something that specifically breaks that pattern. Because then you can end up with players who are like, hey, wait a minute, we got a magic sword. This means I'm now the chosen one. Why aren't I the chosen one? Why aren't you rewarding me for picking up on this and being the chosen one? It's like, well, that blade's cursed and we're actually doing something opposite. So there's a real challenge with this game and writing, and especially as we try and make, you know, new storylines and exciting storylines, is familiar tropes and archetypes turn the audience onto autopilot. And we don't want them to do that. We want them to be engaged and stay with us, and we want them on their toes, and we want them worrying and speculating. And so I find mystery thrillers to be very rewarding to craft, because I have to solve them myself at my, you know, office or my studio. I have to do it on my own. So I get my own mystery to solve, and then to share that with other people and let them walk through what I've figured out is as a writer, I can't ask for anything more.
Do you find it harder to keep with the mystery you're trying to telling what that you're trying to tell in a game that is improv'd?
No. We get asked, it's weird, we get asked a question a lot about how challenging do we find it. We've been together for a long time. We've been together for 4 years working on this type of programming. So I have a really great cast. And I don't mean this in a negative way. I have a very predictable cast, which means that I know what their strengths are. And I know the way that their brains operate. So I know what puzzles to throw down, knowing who's going to pick up on what, which is just teamwork. I've never had a problem juggling things multiple times. And thankfully there's a lot of trust that comes from the table. So I think they might be, and Ned can attest to this, they might be able to hear when I'm doing a very obvious course correction, and everybody can sort of bite into it, and go, oh, we're going down the wrong path. Let's shift gears and go over this way, 'cause this is how it is. So I think the combination of whatever I have acquired up until now that allows me to juggle that stuff so efficiently, mixed with such a fantastic, attentive cast, allows us to really stay in the moment and allows them to keep rolling with the punches instead of feeling too frustrated to continue.
There's also a difference between having a fully produced show versus a home game where everybody at that table understands that you are telling a story and that they need to buy into that in some way and not completely throw a wrench in the plans of what you are creating together.
Yeah, everyone's very much on task. It creates, I mean, we have to be, you know, the old entertainment adage that time is money, and we have a limited time that we're on set. We have a limited number of hours of the day. We're all very committed to following SAG regulations to make sure that we're a union-supported show and everyone's treated fairly and healthily. Playing a game for that many hours for 2 weeks straight is definitely a marathon. We'd only done it for like 7 days max before, so we really had to dig down for the last couple days. And the story is building, and it's getting crazier and more dramatic and heavy as the time goes on. So thankfully, we got a great cast of professionals who know how to stay on task. They know we're all working together, and it allows us to be very efficient with our time, which helps me as a DM greatly.
Ned, do you find that there are any themes that you always fall into when you play characters, or do you always try to keep it fresh and new?
How do I answer that without spoilers?
Pretend that you're not talking about this specific game, you know, just any game in general.
I like being new and different every time I play. I don't like playing the same character every time around. And I think people who have been with us from the beginning in terms of this campaign, and like people who've been with Encounter Party from the beginning, will agree that my character in campaign 2, which is coming to you soon, is nothing like anything I played in the first campaign. Different wants, different dreams, different actions, different focuses. I really like to swing the pendulum every time a new character is coming in. I think as a player, I am generally a puzzle solver. My brain is constantly tracking patterns and constantly looking for, oh, that doesn't make sense. No, that fits there. And I often slot into that space at a table. You know, there are some people who love a combat. There are some people who really live in, like, let's get into the role play. And I think my characters generally become shifting to find ways to solve the problems at hand, no matter what type of player or character I'm playing. I would say that's probably my thematic tie. Is I think part of it is in Encounter Party, but even in my home games, I try to orient tables down the path of story wherever possible. If I see what a DM is trying to do, I try to either go with it because that's what they prepped, or I try to go against it because I think it's against character. But either way, I'm trying to drive story forward at all times. And a lot of that comes from, I would say, puzzle solving, even if it's, you know, solving what's the next thread we pull on the web that's being woven.
There are some pretty cool puzzles in Encounter Party.
Yeah,
Ned has
a very unique ability at the table I've actually never seen in another player before. And maybe it's the nature of the program, and maybe it's just the nature of the fact that he's a producer and also the storyline, the story cut editor and that sort of stuff too. But Ned not only keeps track of what he knows, but he also keeps track of what other people know, but from a perspective that sometimes can be difficult to adopt on your own as a person. And so he's the big picture player isn't quite enough, because Ned is constantly aware of what questions need to be asked, not necessarily what information we need to get. Like, he's constantly aware of what do we need as a team to move the story forward, and whose responsibility at the table is it to get us there. So even if Ned is the one who finds the hole, he will know that that part of the story can only be built on Landry, or can only be built on David Lee Quinn. And so he will cue storyline instances, and he will cue conversation to set them up, to add the content to the story we need so that we can get to where we want to be. So when I say big picture, Ned is very much, while I may be directing the story, Ned knows what the post game is going to look like. And so he's this sort of, B-roll director at the table who's sort of making sure that we get all of the gaps filled that we need so that we end up with all the chunk at the end. It's pretty incredible. And it's very helpful to be able to rely on him.
Yeah.
Very helpful to rely on them. There is a couple of bits in the season, I think, where people are like, why do you keep staring at Ned? And I'm like, well, because we're silently communicating.
I'm begging him to help me, please.
because he's taking cues, so he knows what he needs to do.
Well, here we are now. Another question for beginnings, but now more of the beginnings of what we're really here to talk about today, which is Encounter Party. You started out playing this game. You've now become creators in this wild world of TTRPGs. How did you guys meet each other?
Oh, God, you've explained the story so many times.
There's the easy answer and like the longer, more circuitous answer.
We've got an hour left.
In the spring of 2008, I was graduating high school and I was visiting, summer of 2008. And I was visiting my upcoming college for like freshman orientation, which was Ithaca College. And I was in the theater department. I have a degree in musical theater performance. And we met some of the recently graduated seniors who were still in Ithaca after their senior year before they left. And one of them was Brian. And Brian and I talked for, I think, 60 and a half seconds. Like that had to have been it. It was very short. But we became friends on Facebook during that 60 and a half seconds. Fast forward now to the summer of 2016, I believe. Might be 17. It was either 16 or 17. I was at the Gen Con, which is a gaming convention in Indianapolis, with a web series I had made as part of the Gen Con Film Festival. And I saw Brian post on Facebook, because we'd been friends now for 8 years without any interaction, just set up my booth at Gen Con, swing by and say hi. And I commented being like, hey, I'm also at Gen Con. Let's grab a beer. And that was how Brian and I like met for real in 2017. And then we became friends. We ran into each other at cons a lot because I go to a bunch of them and Brian exhibits his artwork at a bunch of them. And when we were in, I think it was New York Comic Con 2018, might have been Anime NYC.
No, you had come to help me with Anime NYC, I think.
It was Anime. So we were working and we were talking about content. Just like we make stuff. We're both actors. Like, what do we want to make? And something that I was talking about is I have always wanted to make a D&D program. But the way that I make content is I won't make something that I think someone else is already making because I'm not interested in being someone's competition. I will only make something if it feels like a new entry into the space. And I had yet to find a D&D idea that I didn't already consume somewhere. And I would rather support their show than go become their competition. And we had that conversation in November or October, whenever it was, 2018. And then in December, I was at work and Brian called me out of the blue and he was like, Ned, I have an idea. Do you have a second? And he pitched me the idea of the TV show that is now coming out. And I went, oh, that's the idea. My first fiction podcast was new plays from emerging playwrights produced as audio dramas with Broadway actors. And something we would do is we would record the show in 4 to 6 hour readings where we had a director on that live. Every actor had a mic and every actor could retake their lines. And they would, the director would say, that was great. Let's do that scene again. And what I got really good at was editing down the raw footage of that 4 hour session into like a 90 minute to 2 hour play. And so that is, in a nutshell, the skill of editing D&D the way we play the game. Is figuring out the pacing and figuring out the story beats that need to be there. And so I just had this very unique skill set, very attuned to what Brian was talking about. And then the next thing we said was like, oh, well, we're both two actors. We can't afford a TV show. And so Brian said, like, let's make it as a podcast. Like, let's do it. And that was like the genesis of Encounter Party, was we then put out a nationwide casting call. We interviewed, I think, about 40 to 50 people. We knew some of the cast in advance. Some of them were referrals. Some of them were people we only tangentially knew. And we brought everyone out to Chicago in 2019, the very beginning of the year. And we played the first season of Encounter Party over the course of 5 days, five, like 8 to 10 hour days, which is exhausting. And then we took the next 3 months to edit the show. And so that 5 day session turned into a 17 episode show where the average episode is 56 minutes long. And that was exactly what we were talking about, was could we take it and if we remove the pieces that are vital to a D&D gameplay session, but not vital to an audience's experience of a story. If we remove math and some of the tactic debates and rule conversations and inside jokes and snacks at the table, if we just pull that out, we get them, they're there, but if we take them out of the audience project, would people really react well to a story-focused? Brian often uses the cooking metaphor of reduction. I always say like editing by subtraction, but like the distilled all story, no fluff version of a D&D campaign. And that was our pitch on our fourth day of release. After we dropped the first two episodes, we were in the top five shows on Apple's New and Noteworthy charts. And that sort of like kicked off where we ended up, was like, we found ourselves with an audience base of completely, like half of our audience during our first season had never played D&D before. They were there for fantasy fiction. And our show, even though it's D&D, even though you hear dice rolls, even though you hear someone using spell slots and talking about hit points, at its core, what you are getting is an experience of a story that aligns simultaneous with the experience of a player in a way that not a lot of actual plays get to do. I say that like story slash player character in an actual play and audience experience is like two simultaneous snowballs, and sometimes one's in front of the other, like the audience is waiting for the story to catch up, or the audience doesn't understand what the players understand. And we've worked really hard through the way that we play the game and the way we edit the game to leave those experiences parallel at all times. And in doing so, you get a very different kind of tabletop gaming experience. You know, we always say like, we're not interested in being better or worse. Those aren't words that we attach to our work. It's new, it's different, it's something else. We want people to experience our show and go like, oh, I've never experienced a show in that way before. And that's in Counterparty.
It was kind of born out of necessity too. When I originally pitched Ned, was Ned had a history of completion, which is very rare in the indie circuit, of people who actually finish projects that they start. But also, everyone was working in the industry or in other industries. Nobody had the time to commit to a once a week or a, you know, twice a month live stream or something like that. So it was about time efficiency. And so we said, could we get people to commit a week like any other gig, fly them out, and then we'll release later, which gave birth to Ned's editing ideas and all of the strategy that goes into that. Because we very much wanted to come from the entertainment side instead of the gaming side. The idea is we're trying to impress upon people that this is a fantasy fiction television show that uses Dungeons & Dragons as a storytelling device. This is not a show about seven people who play Dungeons & Dragons.
Was that your thought process going into your first season when it was a podcast as well? Or was this a shift you made when it was becoming a TV show instead?
There was always the intent to get to this point. I think there was a little bit of game of me to Ned, and then Ned and I to everyone else, of like this sort of anime is really the best reference to do that, where it's like you have anime villains who keep, every time you think you've figured it out, they transform into a new thing. So we would get to the end of season one and it would be like, okay, cool, now you'll see my real form. And that was like seasons two and three. And then we got to the end of that and it was like, great, everybody, we've actually been setting up a television show. So then we went, you know, we were during the pandemic, unfortunately, but we were pitching. And then, you know, we got some people attached to the project and it was like, cool, you thought you beat me. Now I will show you my true power. And then we go to Wizards of the Coast and do the thing. So it's kind of weird to see everyone that this idea that this is the start of something, which it is, but this is you are now seeing the culmination of 4 years of hard work and planning by Ned and myself, that this was always the goal. When you sat down to listen to Encounter Party in the first week, at that first day, and go, what do these guys got going on? This is kind of some good audio quality. This was all a really long setup to get to what you're about to see now. The just unfortunate nature of time and process is it really took us this long to sort of build the audience base, build the numbers, so we could go to a studio, educate the studio about this fan base, educate them about gaming audiences. Thankfully, the movie came out, which gave us a big bump. This was a pretty long strategy, and we're really excited to kind of be able to show somebody what we've been thinking about for a while.
Yeah, I mean, you say it's like pretty long, but 5 years in the world of entertainment isn't necessarily that long.
No. I mean, I joke a lot about, like, so many people say to me, like, wow, you did it. What's next? Like, they constantly ask me that. And my answer is like, no, you don't understand. 5 years ago, we had this idea. Yeah. Everything prior to this was proof that we could do this. This is minute one. Everything prior to this is in the negative. Like, this is the inciting incident of Encounter Party, is the day that this TV show drops. I think something that I am so grateful for in how this has all played out, I mean, when we made the podcast, we told the cast the idea. Like, we told them, we are making this podcast because we are all actors who do this with the goal of a television program. And if you're willing to come on that journey with us, let's make a hell of a show. And, you know, in the TV program, 6 of the 7 actors have been with us since, well, David Lee Huynh joined our cast in the second season of the original podcast. We had an incredible actor named Eddie Cooper, who also went to our same college. He graduated the year that Brian was about to arrive, in the same way that I was about to arrive when Brian graduated. And Eddie, his career took off. He's a very successful Broadway actor in New York. And so we made the first season with him, and then he got way too busy available doing bigger things than we were doing. And so he ended up having to not be with the show anymore, and David Lee Huynh stepped in. But now the cast of our TV program is the cast of seasons 2 and 3 of Encounter Party, plus Kari Payton. And
that's what I was going to ask, if the cast was able to come with you, and, you know, you've answered
every single person is there with us.
I wrote a 10-page dissertation to Wizards of the Coast explaining to them why the cast needed to stay the way that it was.
And what's so funny is we came into these meetings, and I've been working in TV and theater and film for a long time. I've been in a bunch of meetings where, like, shows or scripts are getting bigger, and now we have to talk about, like, what do we do with that? And often the answer is like, well, you've been making theater with this guy, but it's time to get a Broadway star. And it's like, bah. And so we came into this conversation with Wizards where we knew this was going to come up, and we were so ready to, like, fight for them. And we came in, and they were like, all right, so it's the original cast, and we think we should add one person to the table. And we were like, oh, glad we geared up for war.
The last 7 hours so I spent simple. Memorizing this monologue I was going to tell you. Yeah. Bye.
We were so ready to have to be like, no, it needs to be these people. And they were the ones who were like, this is Encounter Party. We think, for the sake of, like, the way the table will look and the way that, like, right, if there's one person in the middle and that's the DM, then you need an equal number on either side. So you have 6. That's wrong. So you need a 7th person. And that was where it all began. I'm very
Maybe
thankful
they
to
got to, like, page 3 and went, fine.
Yeah. We're like, we're not gonna read the rest of this.
I'm not gonna read the rest of this. Whatever you want.
Did they bring Kari Payton to you, or did you get to kind of look through and see?
Column A, column B. We made a wish list.
For the sake of extreme accuracy, he was my suggestion for the short list that then everyone had to sort of review and sign.
We made a massive list. Wizards made a massive list. Entertainment One made a massive list. And we reached out to a lot of people. We knew we needed a draw. Like, the 6 people from the podcast are incredible. The cast is awesome. But, like, no one's heard of Ned Donovan.
You need a name.
We need a name. Yeah. And so we had conversations with a lot of people, some of whom were not the right fit almost immediately, some of whom could have been perfect but weren't available, some of whom were somewhere in between the two. And Kari was on our list from the beginning, and we ended up on one call with Kari. It was Brian, me, some of the people from Entertainment One, Kari, and Kari's management team. And Brian and I texted each other, and we were like, great, we're done here. Like, someone call Kari and give him a job. That's it. We're over. It was just so clear that he was going to bring something to this table that none of the 6 of us had, And something that I think our show has always prided itself on is every single person as a player at our table, but also then therefore the characters they make are entirely unique. No one feels like anyone else. No one steps on each other's toes. There aren't two people jockeying for the same role at the table. And we, if we were going to expand to seven, we needed another person who fit into that, who filled a role we didn't have already. And it was so clear so fast that Kari was bringing something none of us had, that he could bring a character and a personality and a gameplay style that would just enhance our table, that it was instantly apparent it was Kari. And to his credit, like, 16, the first time I ever really, we did a session zero that was essentially make burner characters play with Kari, but we didn't meet each other's characters. Our session zeros were private with Brian. And so the minute one of the TV shows, the first time I met everyone, and Kari slipped into our table like that, like he filled our
seamlessly,
vibe.
Pretty much.
And we always were, something I was worried about, honestly, and I never really said publicly, but I was stressed that because of his name, the show might become Kari and his six friends. And in no way is that true. Kari fell right into our kind of show. And I think it's, he's from a theater background, so are the rest of us. Like, but he is an incredible professional, an incredible human. And he, I think, leads with a lot of empathy, which means he just felt what was coming off of this table that had spent 4 years developing. And he went, great, this is where I go. And it's perfect.
There was such a youthful energy of wonder that came, because he'd played before, but he'd never played with us. He'd never played with me as a DM. He never played with this table that was so story-driven and story-focused. And I think the minute he sort of stepped in and figured out what was going on, which was by the second day, he really, you know, from minute one, he was there trying to contribute, trying to engage with people, trying to get the ball moving. And he fell in very, very quickly. And, you know, I think like most sort of children, at some point he burned himself on a hot stove. And that, I think, really woke him up to sort of the intensity that we were playing with. And from there, it was just, God, what a blessing to have him join the,
honestly,
crew. I hope we get a chance to play with him for a lot longer.
Season two, putting it on record. Wizards, give us a second season.
For people who may not have listened to Encounter Party as a podcast, we're jumping into a new story, new characters. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
Correct. There's no connection to the old show besides the six cast members.
Gotcha.
And the name, I guess.
Hey, is anyone else out there obsessed with dice? Does anyone out there want to join the I Have Too Many Dice Sets for My Own Good Club? Or is this going to be a party of one? Because I would be the first to tell you that I have a dice problem. But I don't necessarily think that's the worst problem to have. So if you've got the same mindset, Queer PG has a fun little offer for you. If you head over to fanrolldice.com, you can use our code QueerPG10 at checkout to get 10% off your purchase. They've got gemstone dice, my personal favorite. They've got wooden dice, they've got metal dice, and a whole bunch of other designs and accessories to fit all of your dice gremlin needs. So, if you find you're itching for something new to add to your collection, head on over to fanrolldice.com and remember, QueerPG10, that's QueerPG10 at checkout to get 10% off.
This episode is brought to you by Hero Forge. There is no better gift for a gamer than a custom miniature of their beloved TTRPG character. So this holiday season, take the guesswork out of gift giving and treat your players to a digital gift card to Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop miniatures with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser. You can make minis in a variety of materials, including premium unpainted plastic and color standees, and they even offer downloadable model files so you can 3D print your unique designs at home. And for the dice lovers in your party, never fear, Hero Forge has you covered with their custom dice, which lets you put your hero inside the very D20 that will help lead you to glory. Visit heroforge.com to send your players a digital gift card and let them build the heroes of their dreams.
Sanguis populi. The blood of the people. the dark protectors of the hidden city of Azeroth, deep within the illusory forest. Familiar with death as they have eluded it, they are called upon for a desperate task: slaying a creature from the great beyond. Blythe.
This might not be easy, being surrounded by death. I don't understand how they can do it.
Elvira.
Someone must watch the bodies, and none do so as diligently.
Swan.
Into action so fast. I love when we get to go out.
It came from the sky. This great, pale monstrosity.
You just had to sate your hunger. You couldn't have saved it for the beasts.
I prefer the gratuity.
Vampirism is not immortality. It only prolongs the inevitable. Is this the end for Sanguis Populi? Blood in the snow. A tale yet told. Halloween 2025.
Sorceress, lower the barrier for just a moment. Sanguis Populi departs.
Listen to tales yet told wherever you get your podcasts.
Have fun rolling. Did you find that there was anything particularly easy or hard about shifting from a podcast to a fully produced television show? Or because, okay, I don't even have to ask the second part. I see the answers on your faces.
Oh, yes. I'm going to give a different answer.
In the podcast, we played for between, shortest days were probably 7 hours, longest days were probably 10 hours. And it's exhausting. It is exhausting because one of the things that we drill as a cast is at the end of a long day, for us, that's like 7 hours of grueling in it and working hard to stay with it. But for the audience, that's like episode 4. So they're coming in fresh, and therefore we have to come in fresh. And that energy is exhausting. And in the podcast, when story shifts to Andrew Krug and David Lee Quinn having a 30-minute conversation that we're going to edit down into a 6-minute conversation, all the others of us can be like, and just like lean back and let them do their thing. In the TV show, you are on from minute 1 to end of day. And you are never not on because the cameras are what we need for reactions and feelings and how should the audience react to this. Like, it is, it is the most fun acting job I've ever had. I make my living as an actor, and it is absolutely the most fun I've ever had. But it is easily the most exhausting acting work I've ever done.
The only thing that I found more complicated is there's more people's, there's more cooks in the kitchen. You got to answer to more people than just your production partner. And that's a challenge that becomes, a little bit of a dance between, whose right do we think is the more appropriate right to implement, because everyone's correct. Everyone's got a good idea. So, that was the only thing I didn't just have to juggle the table in the game. I also have a stage manager who's talking in my ear, and we have a showrunner and a director who are managing things. And, you're trying to be conscientious so that out of the corner of your eye, you can see a cameraman shift. So you know that they're trying to line up an angle. So you're trying to shift your energy to make sure that that gets captured. So more things to juggle, definitely. But we, Ned and I sink our own money into the podcast, and it's audio only. So the visual element isn't something we ever got to do. But, we have so many things to interact with in the show, and props and these fantastic miniatures and really cool sets. And we have this huge space to work with that isn't just the table. I found it very liberating in a way that the podcast I felt to be very restrictive. Is we could go big, and I could finally show off gameplay at a level that is always in my head that I knew is possible. And this is only the first season of what could be many. And this is This is, in reality, only a taste of what I think our campaigns are capable of. So I'm just hungry for more and more and more and more, because I just want to go bigger.
Well, and the season builds. I mean, something I love as the editor, my job is also to make sure that it continues and vibes and all of that good stuff. And something that I love about the experience of it is after every, let's call it arc, we kind of thought about the show in different chunks of how the season played out. Something grows, right? Like, you're getting something new. There's something to bite into that you haven't experienced in previous episodes yet. And I love that. I love that at each step of the way, not only is the plot growing and growing and growing as the stakes rise for the characters, but also, like, the experience of the show is growing and growing and growing. And just when you think, like, oh, I now know what this show is, you get something you absolutely weren't ready for. And in doing so, like, it makes the simple fact that you are watching a show of seven people sitting around a table never feel monotonous. And I mean, it's a testament to Brian and how he set up the story. It's a testament to the actors and how they were willing to go with their characters. It's a huge testament to our production team. You know, we mentioned John Platt, our showrunner, and Ash Minnick, our stage manager, but, like, everyone from the ground up, our camera team, our PAs, like, across the board, were just incredible at finding new ways to make this show every single filming day, so that you're getting camera angles you haven't seen yet because cameras are readjusting. You're getting lighting ideas that you haven't seen yet because he's held them until episode 11. Like, everything feels like you get something new as the show progresses. And I've seen every single second of the raw footage that was captured, and I think it is a dang joy to watch it grow over 22 episodes.
Just in the concept of confidence of purchase, episode one starts out with a bang. There's no hiding that. It's the first line of the show. But we are aware that there are 22 48-minute episodes that you gotta consume. So we don't come out heavy and then ride neutral for the entire bit. It has to grow, and episode 22 has to be bigger than all the other episodes, and they have to crescendo. And we're very confident that this season does that with very skilled play.
Yeah. So Encounter Party Now, in its iteration, it was never a streamed AP. It was always a podcast. And even now, you're not a streamed AP. It's a TV show. And my own opinion, of course, having seen a few of these episodes, it honestly feels like it's shot kind of like a reality TV show meets a game show. And the fact that you get to see everyone's reactions to Brian's narration, to each other's descriptions, you get the secrets that kind of feel like confessionals in a sense. How did it feel, or why did you want to break from the mold that has become such the thing for TTRPGs to do?
Well, a lot of that credit goes to the people who aren't us, actually. The you know, director of photography, the showrunner, John Platt, who's the showrunner, has had a very successful career making both Big Brother and The Amazing Race. So there are,
and also a lifetime D&D player.
Yeah. Yeah, when we met him the first time, when he was introducing himself after hiring on the showrunner, he brought out notes from a campaign he had written in 1981, right? Yeah. It was that long ago. The old school player. So there was all of that was Entertainment One hiring somebody they knew who could make not just us, but the other programs in a very efficient amount of time. So we learned a lot from John, and he really sort of helped cue us in into something that Ned and I probably could have figured out our own style, but not in the time. And we would have had a problem solved. There would have been a ton of traps that we fell into. So that was something that I think we got to pass off, which again, and these people, like, I play D&D. I know where to put the camera. I know what to see. We had some really great camera people who We were told by the crew too that sometimes we'd have to do pickups because they got so engrossed in the story
that they like forgot to refocus a camera.
They were like, we didn't know that was going to happen. We were pointing over here because we thought this is where it was going to go. And oh my God, now we have to like reset.
I mean, when we pitched the show, Brian and we talked for, look, we made the show in what, 2019? We've been debating what is the visual language of this show for a long time. And we knew it wasn't what I would call like the too many people approach. Is at some point in most streamed APs, unless you have a very talented OBS switchboard or whatever, you are watching one person do great work and five people potentially checked out or listening. It's hard as an audience member when you're taking in that full picture to keep focused if any of the five other people are unfocused. You will always track the unfocused person. And so we knew in the creation of this show, we needed the ability to be in singles or doubles most of the time. We needed to keep it on the person who was speaking and a quick shot to someone reacting and then back to the person speaking at all times to keep the audience invested. And we talked a long time about like, well, what is that? And there was a period of time where we were using World Series of Poker as a kind of like visual touch point. But then we were talking to studios who didn't know Dungeons and Dragons, and they would hear World Series of Poker and they'd start asking who wins. And then we'd have to be like, well, you don't win. It became a problem. So we took it out of the pitch. And so we started talking about cooking competition shows, and more specifically, there were two shows we kind of touched on a lot in the pitch process. And our show doesn't really look like them, but they were like the space in which we could find our show. And they were The Final Table, which was a Netflix show, which has a very big open set. And something we wanted was to get away from that feeling of studio APs where the walls are right behind people and it feels very basement-y. We didn't want our show to feel like that. We wanted to be able to see past people into an expanse with curtains. We wanted that kind of space to be brought into AP. And then secondarily, we talked a lot about Beat Bobby Flay. And Beat Bobby Flay has this really great vibe where even though it's a competition show, the interactions between them and the judges, but at the end of the day, it's cameras capturing people at an oven or at a table. Like, it is a one location show that has hundreds of episodes that feel unique. And we were like, that is what we're trying to do here. And so we took that into our pitches. And when we got to set and we had, Narbe had built this incredible set for us, and we started to meet the camera team and hear about their experiences. Some of them worked for Bravo, some of them worked for, but it was a team of people who knew Unscripted intimately. And they also were longtime D&D people who, some came out of film school, wherever, had a fiction background. We were able to say, like, great, we need you to capture a completely improvised fiction story, and we need you to do it in the same way you recognize that person's about to have a great moment in an unscripted television show. Film them. And that was kind of the mission. And I think they made out it, like bandits. It's crazy. We got into the editing bay and we would say like, oh my God, did you see this shot that someone got of a scene Sarah's not in where she lifted one eyebrow in reaction to herself and it's on camera? Like, and we can use that? Like, it created the ability to guide the audience's attention and inform how the meta story of the people playing the game feels about it, either from the player perspective or the character perspective that you find in a scripted TV show. And that work is incredibly, should be given exclusively to the humans who ran the set when we were in production.
100%.
There's a really kind of encouraging thing about it that was kind of explained to me during the editing process that was, because we were fortunate enough to be given the budget and have all these cameras set up, and we do have these reactions, as you say, because we're focused so hard at keeping the audience in the moment, that can be a real challenge because we're so story focused. Even when players are talking as themselves, they're problem solving. They're debating the story and the narrative and debating where to go. We're never out of advancing the plot. And so those cutaways and those reactions sort of allow and inform the audience that they're having the same reaction. You know, if Ned and Kari are having a scene and we give a quick shot because we caught Sarah reacting, it's very likely that that reaction is going to be the reaction that some of the audiences have. So that will help fill some of that gap that some people are nervous we're abandoning with our program, which is that sort of being real people connected to the game aspect of it, that I think the DP and the showrunner kind of thought of ahead of time. So those things that you've pointed out, I think, are going to help the audience feel more connected to us as people.
This kind of moves into a topic I wanted to talk about, because I believe Ned has spoken on it very briefly before, but as a creator, I understand the idea of, I am making this story for you, and that should be all you need from me. That is what I'm giving you. But I've seen, as an audience member for APs, what people choose to watch or listen to is often chosen because of the specific casts. And so I saw the Polygon article, and I've seen Dr. Emily Friedman's comments about parasociality when related to APs. And I think it's an interesting topic in this world, because it seems to be so, it seems to be what is everybody's relationship to what they're watching and the casts they're watching and the shows they're watching. So I guess the big question is, as you try to break into a new audience with a new type of form of gameplay, I guess, why is it that you're so certain you're going to be able to kind of break from that?
Well, the first thing I would say is, the way that parasociality gets attributed to us is, we have always said that actual plays, if you ignore mechanics, have to focus first and foremost on one of three things, and the other two will always be secondary. It is either players or characters or stories. One of them has to be the thing that your show is known for or vibes like, right? Like, that's just how this art form tends to work. And we looked at the landscape of shows, and the majority of shows we looked at focused on player or character. And very few lived wholly at the story level. And our pitch was never, you're not going to get to know Ned. It was, if you want to know Ned, find us in Discord, talk to us on Twitter. The product we create, every decision is made for a story purpose, for the audience's experience of a story, or we're priming them. Like, a lot of the jokes we leave in the show that are between players are because we are priming the audience for a comedy section, or we want to be able to twist them into drama really quickly. It's all very calculated to the audience's experience of the story. And so a lot of where that conversation comes from is people taking that and saying, like, we don't have player moments in our show, or we don't give you the time to connect to our characters. And that's not true. What we are saying is, all the moments we give you that are connecting with players or connecting with characters are in service of the larger story, and any moment that exists in the capture of our show, which is absolutely necessary for the tabletop game playing experience, in jokes at the table and rule debates and fumbling over words when you try to figure out what you're going to do, all of that, which is vital to the experience of playing the story, isn't vital to the audience's experience of that story. And so we have always stated that if you look at that pyramid, most shows either go players first, characters second, and because of that dynamic, they make a story. Or they say, these characters are amazing, and I love the people who play them, and because of that, here's the dynamic of story. Story is almost always the third of the hierarchy. And we said, what if we invert it? And that is where our show comes from. It's why the episodes can be so short. It's a lot of what we cut. It's not that it's bad content. It's that it's content for a show we're not making. And that is really where I think those comments come from. And so I always come back to, we never want to be better or worse. We just want people to experience our show and say, that's new or that's different. And better or worse is subjective. You can like our show, you can dislike our show. I think you're gonna love it. But I do feel you will not feel like you've experienced a tabletop story the way we tell it. And that is exciting to me because it's something everyone can experience and then decide for themselves how they feel on it. And so the content we put out doesn't feature those elements as strongly as any other program. And the parts that we do leave in the show to give you that experience are for a very specific story experience or for audience understanding of moments that might not be clear if we didn't leave it there.
I'm glad that people have sort of had this term, and I praise Dr. Friedman for sort of giving people a technical term that we can now sort of talk about this topic in. But the layman explanation of parasocial engagement is a one-sided relationship with a celebrity or a character. It's the Friends effect, which that might be a bit dated now, but in the early 90s when Friends came out as a show, there was a new type of social engagement that people were discovering called the Friends effect, which was that when you were watching the television show Friends, you felt like you were part of that group of friends because the way the storylines were developed and the characters were portrayed. And that's why it became very popular, because people felt it to be hangout time. And we're seeing the exact same thing now in Dungeons and Dragons, because people are making programming and content that exhibits the same type of relationships that you either have or wish you had with the people around you. So it can become surrogate. And I think parasocial engagement is an obvious byproduct of this type of content. But the idea that it's a necessary component, or God forbid, an input cost, is just something we're not aligned on. Dungeons and Dragons is a storytelling game. That's the point of the game. The game is to tell and reach the end of the story. This idea of people watching other people play games is new in this version, at least in the tabletop role-playing game. So my question back to you would be, you're about to consume a new program and you want to see some new people and some new stories and some new fantasy adventure, and you want to see what these people have creatively in the experience. What does it matter to you how much it means to me that I get to do this? How does my personal reward affect your understanding of the fictional storytelling? It just doesn't. And we were a new program that was trying to enter the market with a new feel and trying to earn audience time that is already filled with a lot of programs that last much longer than us. I think we're going to experience parasocial engagement. I think people are going to become attached to the players and us as people, because some of our cast is really funny and some of them are really emotional, and there's
it's
going
also
to be...
just unfortunately like something you like as a creator just can't control 100%. How an audience reacts to you.
I think it's unfair to demand it. I think it's unfair to say that part of you enjoying this story is you must have a relationship with me that I don't give back to. And that is necessary for your comprehension. That's just not who we are. And I think it is going to happen. I don't think it doesn't exist in our program. I just think people will experience very quickly when watching Encounter Party that we have decided to remove ourselves from that equation.
Yeah, I think a better way of thinking about it than how it sort of was bandied about from the Polygon article is that we don't actively try to play into it. We don't use it as a tool by which the show grows. You can find us online. We would love to chat with you. We would love to interact with you. We would love to hear your theories and whatever. But we actively choose to make a show where every piece of it is around the story being told. And none of it is primarily focused on how Ned feels about playing the game, or what this is for Ned, or even, frankly, what this is for Flick, Ned's character. It's what's the story Flick is on, Ned is on, and that is how the decisions are made. And that's sort of where this idea comes from, is that we are removing actively and intentionally a lot of things that would play into that audience experience, because it doesn't create the audience experience Encounter Party sets out to create.
And that's why we keep inviting people that Encounter Party is a fantasy adventure that happens to use Dungeons & Dragons to tell that story. We are not asking people to come watch a show about seven people playing a game. We're asking you to come listen to the story about six people who suddenly are thrust in a prophetic vision that predicts two of them are going to die. That is the show.
Thank you for you know, commenting on that, because I do feel like there was some missed explanation when that article came out about exactly what all of that meant. And so I appreciate your thoughts.
It was a great question. Hey, it's hard. We're the show hasn't quite launched yet. And unless you've consumed all of the episodes of the previous show, you know, we're talking on promises here that we haven't had a chance to deliver yet. So,
and we have fans who constantly ask us, like, create a Patreon, release the unedited episodes. And the answer is like, no, that's not in Counterparty. You can get that programming elsewhere.
The only experience and the only information and data that people have collected so far, we're trying to say, hey, we're doing something new and different. But people don't have the reference of that yet because we're not out yet. So we're hoping to continue to get people to invest in the story by promising all you got to do is tune in. And this is going to be all about you from the first line of the show.
This show is more fun to watch than play, which doesn't mean it wasn't fun to play, but the audience's experience of this show is more fun than mine. And I think that's really fun.
Because it was miserable for me to play with these guys.
You're like, I can't believe God. I had to do this for 2 weeks.
Acting.
I think a lot of people in this space get sucked in so much that their entire focus is only ever making TTRPG related content, and that's like just their job, and their hobby becomes the exact same thing, and that's all they do. And I know it took quite a bit of time to get to this point in Counterparty, and I'm sure the filming of it took a lot of time. But if I can ask what it is that you find enjoyment in outside of all of this, I would love to hear that.
Career-wise, I mostly work in musical theater. Like, my world is not actually in tabletop content creation. It is tabletop gaming is a space I love. I also am a rabid National Football League fan, and I will spend all day Sunday watching those games. I love sports. I see a lot of theater. I read a lot of books. Like, I live in a space where, as a quote-unquote content creator, and I don't particularly love the phrase because I think it reduces art, but as a person who makes things, Encounter Party's the first gaming thing I've made. And I make a lot of things. And I think my work outside of the space helps me in the space. And in the same vein, sometimes I don't play in my home games because I've been editing Encounter Party for 70 hours this week and I just don't want more D&D. You know, I like hanging out with my dog.
I also like hanging out with my dog. Ned kind of alluded to it earlier in the show. I have I do have another career that I've been doing. I've been fortunate enough to have a fine art career, so I have a label called Ukiyo Pop, and we exhibit at conventions around the country. So I spend a lot of my in between time doing that. I enjoy going to conventions. I'm a pretty big gamer. I like video games. Find them a great way. I really like narrative video games too. Like, I like diving into a story because it's cool to see people use video games as a medium and a level of immersion that you can't really get from other kinds of medias. But my big hobby is cooking. That's my big hobby is I like it. It's just kind of another art form for me. I entered college sort of right when Food Network became a thing, and I got obsessed immediately, and I just like food. So I cook every day, and I spend a lot of time planning meals and having fun with that.
You guys might not feel the same way, but I often feel like being able to do other things in my life than work often helps the creative flow when I'm working. And so I think it's super important, and I think a lot of people forget about that. In the world of entertainment in general, I think people forget about that a lot. So.
Oh, I never come up with the solution of my writing problems while I'm writing. Never. I'll be out for a walk, or I'll be chopping an onion or something, and I'll get the idea of, oh, I could chop Ned's character up like an onion. This would be great.
Didn't love that. I started making stuff. I mean, I've been making stuff for a long time, but there was a period of time in my life where I was forced to stop acting for about 2 years. And the only way I had creative outlets was producing things. I started making podcasts and movies and music, and art became my escape from a really crap situation. And then those things started to take off. People liked them. And when I came back to New York after 2 years away, I decided to take an extended leave of absence from acting. And I got, you know, quote unquote, real jobs that I used to fund my projects. And I only was very fortunate enough to come back to acting as kind of my full-time gig 2 years ago. And that's something that I think I really focus on. I'm so fortunate that my bills are generally paid by the thing I love to do. But also, when I was working exclusively as an actor, I got really burned out on acting, and I had to start writing stuff to keep my brain awake, like to keep my artistic drive alive, because I was doing things that I felt a little artistically stifled. Vice versa, when I was exclusively writing stuff, all I wanted to do was start acting for other people. And I think like that's built around the fact that it is nearly impossible to spend 100% of your life doing a thing that you love. There has to be things that you love, and some of them are things you want to do as full time as possible. But if you are only doing those things, it doesn't matter how much you love them, you're gonna burn out super hard. And for me, I work really hard to make sure that that's always true. Because if I spend too much time in the weeds on Encounter Party, Encounter Party suffers. So why do that?
I took the entire month of September off, and fortunate enough to be in a position to do that, but I had worked.
Yeah.
I had banked up more than enough time before that. I went on a little trip by myself with my dog, just to sort of clear the brain. And by the end of September, I was talking with Andrew Kruger's on the cast, and I said, yeah, I'm ready to write season two if we get it. I'm ready to dive back in if we need it. So I highly advise people who are in the grind of content creation, put in your work, buckle down, roll up your sleeves, get it done, and then find a time ahead of time when you get yourself a deadline so that you have a time to be done.
I guess this also, just the mentions of writing here actually brings me to another question I had about Encounter Party real quick. Most DMs, unless they have a partner DM, are used to crafting a story completely alone. But seeing as you had like a production and creative team on the TV show, were you still crafting this whole, I know the players didn't know anything about it, but was it still all you crafting the story? Did you have people to bounce ideas off of to help you fix solutions? What was that process like?
First of all, what is a co-DM?
Oh, you've never...
Who's crutching on somebody else?
Oh, no. A lot of
co-DMing's
times...
cool.
Yeah, they... Oh,
is it where you just kind of take
yeah,
turns?
Yeah, you take turns DMing, yeah.
Oh, okay, that's pretty cool. That would be a great idea to... I like that idea if you didn't really have a strong plan, like somebody's job is only to create one game night and
yeah,
then...
but it's a continuous story.
Yeah, yeah. And then, oh, so you have to take that session and then it's your turn to prepare. That's yeah. Cool. I would do that with somebody. That's a great idea. Because of a lot of reasons. Because of there's a lot of reasons that I don't need to take up 5 minutes in an interview to explain. But no, the answer is I am essentially the solo campaign writer. There's a approval processes, you know, Wizards of the Coast has to check in. We get game mechanics checked. We are fortunate enough to go through a very strict DEI review to make sure that we're being appropriate with our content. You know, every once in a while I slip something in that they're like, hey, you didn't know about that. I think I wrote a character that they were like, this name sounds very close to the name about a historical figure who was terrible that you didn't know. And I had like a character who actually shared a name with a minor Polynesian god. And that stuff, that stuff's going to slip through the cracks. So it's I will say with all the honesty in the world, the DEI agency was great. And there's not a single thing that they said that they weren't right on. And there is not a single thing they expressed that I felt stifled or insulted by bringing that stuff up. But other than that, it was really kind of hands off about the campaign.
I've produced a lot of fiction content. I've never produced fiction content where I don't know the fiction. And pitching a television show, we joke about it all the time, but we'd be in the middle of a pitch with like industry professionals. And Brian would be like, all right, Ned, leave. And I would drop the Zoom call. And then he would text me 20 minutes later and I would come back. That's crazy. That's the kind of experience you don't generally have when you make content the way we do. I think it's a really fun byproduct of our story. It's a lot of faith to put in Brian, but then one of the things that Brian and I laugh about is once we're done, it's mine. Like, I pick where episodes start and stop. I pick what ends up in the show. It is my job to take what we all improvised and Brian wrote and then we all experienced together and get it to 48 minutes exactly per episode. And that is I think it's a really fun thing. We actually had some conversations on set early on where people are like, great, and where does the first episode stop? And we'd be like, oh, we might be in the third episode. We have no idea. We'll let you know in the editing booth. Like, we just don't. No. And there's something really freeing about that. There's something really fun about that. Some episodes, I mean, in the podcast, episode length was variable, right? The shortest episode, I think, was 44 minutes. The longest was 75. The TV show is exactly 48 every single time. And that was a hard thing to find. But it's really fun to sit there and then, you know, we'd edit down a show. We never started saying, like, this is episode one. We would just get 7 hours of footage. And then we would just start cutting it down and leaving ourselves notes saying like, this might be an ad break. This might be the end of an episode. This is an arc. And then when we were done with the day, we'd say, hey, go every 40 minutes and see if we got lucky. And sometimes it was like, great, that's the episode. And sometimes I'd have to call Brian and say like, will you kill me if this 6-minute scene we love just isn't in the show? So we can get to an episode ending. And that was hard stuff.
As long as it isn't vital content, yeah, we're pretty aggressive about that.
Yeah, and that's really, I think, the secondary art form of this show is we play a story without constraint of episode starts and stops. It's just that we as a team are very cognizant that roughly every 3 hours, we got to find something. And Brian's really skilled at dropping a lot of potential cliffhangers into the plot. So if I need them later, that's the end of an episode. And that's a decision we made a long time ago that we honed over 3 seasons of a podcast.
And also, Encounter Party is and always will be a mystery thriller as long as I'm in the DM seat. I want people guessing. I want things coming out of nowhere. I want twists. I want turns. I want people getting, you know, different experiences from multiple viewings. I want to reward people who invest the most. As long as I'm in charge of the DM seat, this will always be a mystery thriller. And quite honestly, that works most efficiently if I'm allowed to just write alone.
Well, we are coming to the end here, and I want to thank you guys so much again for giving us some of your time. Before you go, though, I do have one last question. Could you tell me one of your favorite moments at a table? It doesn't have to be Encounter Party. I'm not asking for any spoilers here, but it can be happy. It can be sad. Just something that has kind of stuck with you, something you look back and remember fondly.
I know a great one because it just happened.
Please.
I was at Game Hole Con up in Madison, Wisconsin, and met connected with another LGBTQ DM here in the Chicagoland area. So it was nice to connect with others like myself. And he was running a game with a system. And to tell this as succinctly as possible, we got pre-generated characters. And it's a 5e modification that basically doesn't use spell slots. You build something called corruption. So you basically bank bad things in the hope that you don't bank enough bad things that you get punished for being cavalier. And I was given this sort of like sickly wizard young man. And I just made the decision that with the character that I said, who's the top person in the pantheon? Great. He's my God. I have faith in him. And I just don't believe that this exists. I just do not believe that the concept of corruption exists. I do not believe there's a penalty. I think people are suffering because they have bad faith. So imagine playing Dungeons and Dragons and somebody saying, I don't believe spell slots exist. I'm just going to cast them free will because I just don't believe they exist. And as the game continued to try and punish me, my dice rolls got better and better and better until I was going to go complete, just not become a person anymore. And I instead rolled a natural 20 and got silver eyes that could suddenly see evil. And we discovered who the real villain was, who was a puppet. And I've never been in a situation where I literally just said, this isn't real. And had the game fail to punish me and change my mind, because we were all expecting that to happen.
Yeah.
Okay, when the come ups happens, we'll deal with it. And Brian will have to deal with his character being exposed to the truth. But it never happened. And I was never punished for my choices. And that was one of the most exciting things for everyone at the table. That was great. That was fun.
When I was first playing tabletop games, I was in a game, I don't even remember what system it was. I was probably 11 years old. And there was a situation, it was a like a modern warfare, no spells, all gunslinging kind of game. And we were like trying to take this fort, and there were guards everywhere. And the game master was like, and they're all hidden and they're all wearing camouflage and you don't have any things that can try and find them. And you got to figure out how to get to this fort without getting shot by snipers. And we managed to take down one sniper and this kid at the table who had never played a tabletop game of any kind before was like, are they wearing a radio? And he was like, yeah. And he grabbed the radio and he said like, hey, I'm like Echo whatever checking out for the night. Like, raise your gun if you confirm. And then rolled really well. So my whole team, it was like, they were like, yeah. And we were able to just like pinpoint the snipers and like walk their way through. And it's one of the reasons why I always love playing with new people is the more people play these games, the more locked into the way these games work they become. And they forget that part of the fun of the game is coming up with new ways to think about a problem. And I've always thought about that kid who was like, oh, we just need them to identify themselves. And he like looked at the guy's call sign that was on his tag and it was like Echo 6. And he was like, Echo 6, changing shift. And it changed everything. And that's like, I think about that moment a lot when I play RPGs.
As soon as somebody new finds out that they can do anything, that's when they get too much power.
Yeah, they get really creative, which is good. And to all the DMs out there, let's pour one out for all of our big bad guys that get instantly crushed by unfair die rolls.
So sad. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on and chatting with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. For our listeners, you can watch Encounter Party on the D&D Adventures channel on Plex and Freevee starting on November 14th.
New episodes release every Tuesday, reruns on Friday. It'll be 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. And with 22 episodes, you're going to get episodes through mid-April. When was the last time a TV show told you that?
Well, again, thank you so much. And for everybody who is listening, until next time. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening. You can find QueerPG on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at QueerPGPod. And you can find us on Blue Sky at queerpg.blsky.social. QueerPG is made possible by all of you who listen and share the show. We love having these guests on, and it makes it all the more possible when you rate and review. You can also support the show by signing up for our Patreon at patreon.com/queerpg. A perk of signing up for our Queerio tier is that you get to see the video interviews of Press Pause Let's Chat. If you're interested in seeing transcripts for the episodes, all of those from previous episodes and episodes to come can be found on our website, queerpg.com, or our Patreon. Until next time.